Hello and welcome back after a few week hiatus to another episode of Impact Factor. This week I had a chance to catch up with an old college classmate of mine, a fellow physics major, astrophysics actually, and he shares about his experience and how he's now kind of pivoted fields. So without further ado, here is Oliver Elbert, PhD. So, my first question to you, Oliver, is I know the answer to this question. Where did you go to college? Where did you go to undergrad, and what did you major in?
I went to Haverford College. You may have heard of it.
Yes.
Yeah, small school outside of Philadelphia. And I majored in astrophysics. Yeah.
Okay.
After relatively little thought on my part, actually, compared to what I thought going into college, at least.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I also know the answer to this question, but you had the experience to do research as an undergrad. Mm-hmm. So what was that like?
It was interesting. I mean, so the summer after my sophomore year in college, I was doing research with actually a visiting professor at the time, Jorge Moreno. And a lot of that ended up being kind of me teaching myself computer programming. And then in the last, 3-ish weeks, being able to actually write code that was interesting and useful for an undergraduate for running some experiments, essentially. It was
apply what you had been learning.
Yeah, basically. So the idea was, you don't need to get into a ton of specifics, but the idea was using this particular numerical method that is a good way to estimate or to generate galaxy merger histories, just sort of randomly, and using that to essentially try to find how likely it is to have galaxies that undergo major mergers very back to back, with the idea being that those would be potential sites to have two supermassive black holes at the same time before the black holes had merged together as sort of the part of those major mergers. Or I guess two active galactic nuclei, now that I think back to it. This is 15 years ago now.
Yeah, right.
It's actually literally 14 years ago. But yeah, so during the thinking was after a major merger, there's a lot of new mass to accrete onto the black hole at the center of a galaxy, which turns it into an active galactic nucleus. And so if you have two of these back to back, maybe you can have still have one AGN, and then maybe a second one that's kind of orbiting it, was the thinking. And so I was just basically using this particular numerical method to generate a ton of merger histories for hypothetical galaxy clusters, and trying to do some statistical estimation of how frequently they would just have these back-to-back major mergers. But I had never done any computer programming before. I'd never even really thought about how a computer works. And so I literally, Jorge gave me a C++ textbook and was go through this for maybe a month or so, and we'll see where you're at, and then we'll go from there. And now literally numerical methods is my job.
Wow.
This is what
Full
I do
circle.
For a living. So thinking about that, it's just wild to me. It's very, very similar to some of the stuff that I was doing just during my first REU at Haverford. But I mean,
that's crazy.
Yeah. But it was also very cool because being on campus during the summer and having, a lot of my friends from the physics department and from around campus, around the school, who are also there doing their own research, was just like, I don't know, it was a lot of fun, especially because the alternative for me was going home and baling hay all summer. So
excellent.
Yeah. Yeah. And then senior year, or the summer before my senior year, I did most of the research that would become my senior thesis with Beth Willman. And that was, instead of like running these numerical simulations, it was analyzing a high resolution simulation of the Milky Way, which turned into a lot of, like, was very good prep for a lot of the research that I was doing as a grad student, where I was running and analyzing these N-body simulations. And I mean, I think just like as a budding scientist, I got a lot more out of that because, you know, I'd, mm-hmm. you know, I'd had an extra year of education. I'd already sort of gone through some of the preliminary stuff about, well, about coding, but also about just sort of how to do research and like how to read a paper. And so I was much more able to mm-hmm. jump into it and get stuff out of it. But yeah, it was great.
So looking back on it, or maybe you don't have an answer to this, but is there a point at which you feel like you thought, you know, I want to keep doing this. I want to get a PhD. I don't, you know, I'm not ready to just like enter the working world.
I don't think it was about entering the working world so much for me. What I mean, so like when I went to college, right, we went to a small liberal arts school, and I like very deliberately wanted that because I had no idea what I wanted to do or what I wanted to study. I think during the, you know, my first semester in undergrad, I variously thought I would major in like economics, history, linguistics, like tons of different subjects, English. Yeah, like
sounds like a normal Haverford first year.
Exactly, right? Basically, so one of my friends who was a sophomore said I had to take this particular class, which was the freshman seminar in astrophysics, because it was just mm-hmm. like super cool. And I don't know, did you take that when you were a freshman?
It was like a night class, right?
Yeah, once a week, yeah. Nightly. With Steve
Bond.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very good class.
It was one of the best classes that I have ever taken in any context. And it, like, I just kind of fell in love with the subject matter from that and thought, like, if I can keep doing this and like stuff like this, then like, that's just what I want to do. And Everything kind of fell into place from there. And yeah, so that's literally, that's why I majored in astrophysics. That's like what set me on the path to going to grad school. And I guess is how I got to where I am now. So like, if ever your weather forecast is wrong, you can blame Steve Bond for that, for setting me on the path to muck it up.
There you go. I think that class probably had a really positive impact on a lot of people.
Yeah.
It's always fun to look back and like remember that class that kind of changed your perspective on a whole subject, which is very cool.
Yeah, for sure.
So when you were graduating from Haverford, did you go right into your PhD?
Yeah, I started, just right away. I mean, I had that summer, but otherwise, yeah.
Yeah. So when you were looking for programs, were you looking for astrophysics or a specific field in astrophysics, or what was your focus there?
So my focus, again, this kind of derives a little bit from that freshman seminar, right? Like being able to like, because all of the research that I had done as an undergraduate was computational in some way or another, right? Either a lot of data analysis or running simulations, numerical methods type stuff. But the thing that I had really fallen in love with was a lot of that blackboard theory work. Yeah. And so what I was trying to, or what I knew that I wanted out of like grad school was a place where I could kind of combine those, right? And so be doing astronomy work in like a physics context. So I was specifically looking for schools that had combined physics and astronomy departments, which is not always super common, and it's not certainly among a lot of like the top tier, at least the top tier astronomy programs. Most of them are separate from the physics departments, but like I knew that I wanted to be able to be doing more physics-y stuff as like part of my PhD and as part of my research than just sort of a pure astronomy degree. And so that's why, so UC Irvine has that set up. So my PhD is in physics. And like when I was in grad school, I did the full like physics, like core physics curriculum. And then I took actually both the astronomy and the particle physics electives. So I actually had essentially another year of coursework compared to most of the rest of my cohort. But then, you know, I was able to actually take that and synthesize kind of the work that I wanted and the research that I wanted to do from that. It was definitely a very like deliberate choice on my part.
Yeah.
Yeah. As far as the programs themselves.
That's very insightful for you as a college senior.
Well, I, to be fair, had a lot of my undergraduate advisor, Beth Woolman, was, she was really phenomenal. And I mean, she still is a phenomenal person, but like she was really helpful. And also, I mean, I still kept in touch with Steve Bohan a lot. I mean, I took a bunch of courses from him as an undergrad. So like not just the freshman seminar. So I was able to actually, have those kinds of conversations with them. And I think one thing that I am really grateful for is that they, and all of the professors at Haverford really took that seriously and were able to give me the sort of feedback and space to have those conversations to get that kind of insight into like what I wanted and what I should be trying to look for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great. I mean, that's one of the benefits of a small school is that there's someone to talk to about this stuff.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you can get that at a large school too. There's like, to be sure, but you kind of have to push for it a lot more. And I think I certainly benefited from that being more of just like the default at Haverford compared to like if I had had to go more out of my way, I'm not sure that I just, based on where I was in life and as a person at that point, I'm not sure that I would have done it or really thought to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So going back to this, finding this program that was the right fit for you, were you able to find a PhD advisor that was doing the same sort of overlapping topic that you were interested in?
Yeah, sort of. There were, so my PhD advisor was primarily doing like galaxy formation and cosmology as like his... galaxy evolution, galaxy formation, and cosmology is his main like areas of focus. But he, just by virtue of being in the department, had a lot of collaboration with a few other professors in the department who were looking at more of the overlap with particle physics and then particle physicists themselves. So I like to back up. My research was mostly on looking at different dark matter models and trying to distinguish these different candidate dark matter particles based on what potential impacts they would have on the way that galaxies form and evolve and the way that they look to us when we, see them out in the night sky. So there was some work done in part just to like look at, here are the different candidate particles. This is sort of how these particles behave as a matter of like high energy particle physics, and then translating that into how they would sort of behave on aggregate in the context of the dark matter halo of a galaxy. And then so like based on how that halo is different, depending on these different dark matter particles, then how do the galaxies appear different to us?
Interesting.
Yeah, so that's sort of the big picture. So I was able to like live there. And that was kind of exactly what I wanted to be working on. It sounds like
a very unique intersection of your interests.
Yeah, it was extremely cool. So when I got to UC Irvine, which is where I did my PhD, there was a grad student who was just finishing who had started looking at some of this. And I basically was able to kind of tag along and like watch him during my first year, in addition to, you know, doing all of my courses and studying for qualifying exams and everything. And then kind of pick up a bit where he left off with that. And then that sort of opened up doors to collaborating with, you know, people who were doing particle physics to sort of get at what the actual like particle physics implications of these models were. And then, but then also, you know, looking at a lot of issues in like galaxy formation and evolution, because, well, if you want to be looking at, you know, if you want to look at the impact of like a different dark matter model, you also have to then be modeling the actual like stars and gas in a galaxy correctly. And if you want to model that correctly, that means you also actually have to get like understand the reionization history of the universe pretty well. And it just sort of, there were a lot of ways to build out like actually a pretty rich and diverse set of research interests from just like this one question, which I think is, from like everybody I've talked to, that's kind of how it goes for a lot of people doing, especially doing theory, which is you have this like one thing you want, this one string you want to pull, and eventually you just get the whole sweater.
And unravels
real quick. Very quickly. But and then of course, like I ended up giving it all up and walking away from academia, and then accidentally ending up coming back in a totally different field. But
cool.
Yeah.
Well, we'll get to that, but I have a question about what you said about understanding how with the dark matter model, the galaxy looks different to us, right? That's what you said. So when you say that, is that like visually through like a telescope, or is that through like data collection and analysis?
Primarily...
Is that a real question?
Yeah, no, I mean, so like there's... That is such a real question that there are like three different ways to answer it.
Love that. Hit the nail on the head. Good job, Katie.
Exactly. So, I mean, like mostly what we were thinking about was, I mean, everything that all of the data in astronomy for the most part is comes from light in some manner or other, right? I guess not so anymore. Now we also have, sound. We have the literal fluctuations of space-time.
Soon we'll have smell, I hear.
Yeah, that's right. But yeah, now we have like people who are doing like astronomy and astrophysics like with this like gravitational wave detection, which is super cool, and like I'm extremely jealous of that. But like for the most part, almost all of the data sets that I was working with were based on light, right? And you can see potentially some just like visual differences in galaxies if you look at sort of different bands of light, right? So have you heard of the Bullitt cluster?
I have not.
Okay, so it's the Bullitt cluster is this galaxy cluster where you have these two huge galaxies that are merging, and if you look at sort of in one band where all of like essentially the hydrogen gas is, it just like smushed together and is like right at the center of like where these two galaxies merged. And if you look at where the stars are, for the most part, like stars don't really behave like fluids. They just kind of pass each other. I mean, they interact with each other mostly just gravitationally, right? So they kind of pass each other and then go back. And then if you look, we have some proxies for like the overall mass distribution, and you can see that the actual mass of the most of the mass of these clusters is dark matter, right? And you see the dark matter also just like passed for the most part through like the dark matter from each galaxy passed through each other as well.
Okay.
And that sets some constraints on like how much these dark matter particles can interact with each other, and how you can think of like how sort of viscous they are as like fluids when they come into contact like that. But there's actually a lot of leeway in just like those constraints are not, I mean, they're good, but they're not like super tight necessarily. Mm-hmm. And then when we look at, you know, stars in a galaxy, right, we can look at the spectrum of the light from the stars, and we know roughly what like the spectrum should look like if the star was like not moving towards us or away from us. And so you can see like how fast the galaxy is rotating from this spectroscopic data.
Oh, cool.
Right. And then that also gives you some information about how the mass is distributed. And that also can be different depending on the dark matter model. Again, assuming that you also have like the distribution of the stars and the stellar formation history and all of that correct for your galaxy. And you also have the merger history correct. And you also have like all of these other things. So,
And also that.
Yeah,
also
exactly. That. And this is how you build a research repertoire.
That's why it takes 5 years. Yeah.
Actually six for me, but yeah.
Six for you.
Yeah. The normative time to degree in my department was six. Yeah.
Yeah. I've heard that from physics and chemistry a lot too. And biology actually. Sometimes 6 to 8 in biology because you have to grow the mice.
I have some friends in condensed matter physics where they have to build the refrigerator before they can start their experiments, and I know of one person who took 12 years, which I would not. if that were the perspective, I think I would just have gone into industry or gone into almost anything else. So I think that would have killed me.
I think I feel the same. So, okay. So let's, you know, fast forward. So you're wrapping up your PhD. What are you thinking for next steps at that point?
So I was thinking a lot of things. I mean, so I, sort of like I said, I had all of these different interests that were like building out of this one like primary question I was trying to answer. And, you know, I had started collaborating with more and more people and had, I guess, proposals for different research projects. And it seemed very natural to just step right into a postdoc and start and just, you know, continue doing research and, you know, more like independently as a postdoc than as a graduate student. And so, you know, I applied for postdocs, I applied for fellowships. And this was in the sort of fall of 2016 when I was starting these applications. And I was also getting married at the exact same time.
Nice.
Yeah. My wedding anniversary is October 1st. So like literally I took a break from writing my NSF proposal to plan the wedding, basically. I think the proposals were due just before that, I want to say, or maybe just after. But yeah. So and then as I was sort of thinking about partly I was thinking about sort of my values as a just like as a person and as a partner, and then also what I am thinking about sort of what the perspectives were as a researcher. And, you know, different fields are different, but I think in astronomy, certainly at the time that I was looking at postdocs, you know, the trend was typically like grad school, postdoc, tenure track job, if you are lucky enough to get a tenure track job, right?
Yep.
And like that was not very appealing. And I was thinking about like, so, you know, I did my PhD in California. My wife, who's also from Haverford, we met at Haverford. She had moved out to California to live with me. You know, while I was doing my PhD, and we both wanted to live closer to our families. She's originally from Maryland. I'm originally from New Jersey. So we wanted to get back to the East Coast. And I realized, like, okay, if I only apply to postdocs that are in like this geographic area, and then I do that again, and then I do the same thing again for like tenure track jobs. But also, like, you know, we've spent 6 years, or I've spent 6 years of my life, 4 years of her life, you know, living somewhere determined entirely by like my career path, and like then having to move somewhere that like she doesn't really get a say in, and then doing that again, and then potentially a third time,
and then again,
right? Yeah. Like, that doesn't feel, that's like completely inequitable just from like a partnership perspective. And then I don't remember if, I don't know if you or your listeners remember the sort of winter of like 2016-2017, but that was a pretty intense time generally.
Yeah,
there was a lot of stuff going on.
There was.
And so I was thinking about, like, as much as I really loved the research that I was doing and what I was working on and was really into the prospect of continuing that, at that like specific moment in history, it didn't feel feasible to continue just sort of being in academia, working on stuff that's, you know, tangentially related to people's day-to-day lives at like the very best, and for the most part, not at all. And I kind of felt like I actually, both for just like my feelings of how I wanted to like live my life in terms of, you know, my relationship with my wife and, you know, starting a family together, and also like my parents are a little on the older side and wanting to like be closer to them. And then also just sort of more broadly how I wanted to live in the world at that time.
At that point, yeah.
Yeah, I thought like, I don't think I can just take a postdoc guilt-free and like continue on this academic path. So I actually turned down the fellowship offer that I was like super excited to take. And I didn't have a backup plan, hadn't been using any of the resources that my university like very much puts forward for PhD students who are leaving academia. And I was like, okay, so I'm defending in 5 or 6 months, and I have no idea what I'm gonna be doing.
No plan.
So I need to, like, the first thing I did was like, how do I convert my CV into a resume?
Nice.
And it just kind of decided to wing it from there. Pretty radical change of plans at nearly the last minute for me.
I've heard a few of those, and generally it's the right decision, because it's you're following your gut, you know. It's not, you know, what you thought, but it's what you feel.
Yeah, I think there are absolutely things that I miss about astrophysics and about doing that. And I think especially having spent literally 6 years of my life, not counting, you know, undergrad, training myself and like really inculcating myself in this field and like understanding a lot of like the nuances of, you know, why this is an interesting question and why this is not, on the other hand, is not a particularly interesting like set of things to look into, and like all of that. Like, I miss feeling that level of expertise, especially like in my current context where I am very much still a newcomer trying basically to start from like, you know, beginner grad student again. But like, I do think it was the right call for me then. And I think I think my main regret is that I hadn't sort of realized that sooner, basically.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So where did you end up?
So I was unemployed for a bit and then working as a tutor. And then actually these guys who were also like PhD students at UC Irvine in the 90s and like the early 90s had started an aerospace company in the area. And so I like reached out to them on literally just on LinkedIn, reached out to this guy who's the CEO of a small aerospace startup ish company. And he was like, yeah, come in for an interview. I'd be happy to chat.
Wow.
And like, we literally like chatted about having some of the same professors for some of our courses, or, you know, 30, at least 25 ish years apart.
Oh, damn.
Yeah.
That's a long time.
It was really, yeah. But yeah. And so like, I was there for a bit, mostly working on, doing some like machine learning stuff, and also, helping to develop a web app for like mostly monitoring and doing space traffic management for geostationary satellites, which was very cool. And
that was in California?
Yeah. So that was in California. So at this point, so my wife was working at SpaceX, and we knew we wanted to move back to the East Coast, but like I hadn't quite been able to find a job trying to apply across the country. And she was still working at SpaceX. And so like, this was a job offer, and I was like, okay, I'll take it.
Yeah.
But then summer of 2019, one of my friends from grad school who like sat literally in the same office as me, she and her husband had also left the field. They actually were both PhD students at UCI together, but like working on different things in different labs. But they both had left the field, and they had, I think they both did the Insight data science boot camp. And so they moved to Seattle, and she had just started working on this climate modeling team at Vulcan Inc., which is like the holding company that the late Paul Allen used for like all of his stuff. So like Vulcan technically owns like the Seahawks, the Portland Trailblazers, all of the all of that stuff. But also it had a group of teams of like software engineering teams working on essentially like philanthropic tech stuff that Paul Allen was interested in. And like basically right before he died, he hired these guys to start a climate modeling team. And one half of the climate modeling team was doing like machine learning, basically trying to use machine learning in climate modeling and weather forecasting. And then the other half was building a new programming language for weather and climate models in order to, one, finally leave Fortran behind, and then two, also be able to take advantage of a lot of the new supercomputers that are coming online actually now, which use GPUs to get most of their performance. Previously, most supercomputers were just purely CPU based, and Fortran is not very optimized or optimizable for GPUs. They needed somebody to embed at this NOAA lab in Princeton, New Jersey, who had some experience as like a domain scientist running numerical simulations, which was most of what I was doing for graduate school, when I wasn't at a Blackboard. So my friend from grad school, she had just been hired onto the machine learning team. And she knew that we were trying to move back to the East Coast, and she knew that like I sort of roughly lined up with the things that they were looking for this like embedded like half engineer, half liaison position, where I would be essentially half a contributor to like the software engineering, and then half like responsible for keeping in touch with the NOAA team and making sure that like the thing that we were actually building was something they actually wanted to use and would find useful. So I applied and I got that job. And so we moved from California back to New Jersey. And after that effort wrapped up, the NOAA lab hired me on to continue that work and to sort of be a scientist within NOAA. And so that's where I am now.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. It's interesting too, because I think, I don't know for sure, but like, it sounds like your connection with your graduate school classmate was sort of the bridge you needed from like one field to another, where the skill sets can still be applied, right?
Yeah,
like absolutely. The things that you had been learning you can now use, but it's for a whole different application than you would have thought, you know?
Yeah, precisely. I mean, so it's funny, when I was working at this aerospace company, like, it was very cool to be like doing stuff with satellites and like reading papers about, you know, the latest machine learning methods and thinking about ways to apply them. But I did miss like some of the work on like, you know, running a simulation on a supercomputer, or I did miss like kind of diving into the guts of one of these numerical models to try and figure out like exactly how it was working and sort of come to grips with it. I have this like problem that where I can't like use anything without first wanting to understand how it works. It's so like anytime, like, you know, a lot of the people in my graduate lab, I mean, we all ran these numerical simulations, and like everybody, of course, you know, wanted to understand how they worked and like what the sort of algorithm was. It's a standard part of it. But I like really tried to like dive deep into like exactly what was going on and why and like how these optimizations were being done. And that was, yeah, exactly what ended up being useful and kind of necessary for this position. And yeah, I totally, completely would not have even known about it if my friend hadn't just like sent me a Facebook message being like, hey, this is a position. You're still trying to move to the East Coast, right? We need somebody. You would be a good fit. Like, you should apply.
Yeah, because I think I think pivoting like that sometimes can be hard if you're trying to do it independently.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you may feel that your skills are applicable to this tangential field, but you're up against people who maybe have degrees in that specific field.
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of it. But I think also just like, it was not a thing that I had considered. I literally hadn't, like, I was thinking
you about, wouldn't have seen that posting.
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't on my radar at all. Like, I was, you know, coming out of grad school, you know, I was thinking like, okay, I've spent a lot of time, you know, on a computer. I can do stuff like software engineer stuff. I can do, you know, data science stuff. So a lot of the things I was looking at were sort of related to that. And I was just like completely not thinking about going to another scientific field. But actually, it turns out there are a lot of people who have kind of made a, if not this exact transition, a very similar one. Like, I was having lunch yesterday with a couple of other people at the lab, and one of the guys was like, who's an oceanographer, and I was like, oh yeah, I did my PhD in string theory, right? And another guy was like, yeah, I was working actually on, I was doing astronomy, but I was working on like the atmosphere of Venus, and now I'm doing, you know, stuff with the Earth's atmosphere.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it's not actually an uncommon transition, but it was completely one that I had not even considered before. But now I'm like, as part of trying to build up a team and like some capability within NOAA and also within NASA, actually, I'm like trying to go and like hit up all of these physics and astronomy and astrophysics departments and be like, send me your grad students, send me your undergrads. Yeah. So yeah, any listeners so cool. out there, you know,
if you want to make the pivot, you won't be the first.
You will not. And I would be happy to talk about it at great length.
Before we move on, I want to go back to what you said about needing to understand something fully before you use it. Does this apply to things like a toaster and other things in your life?
Not to that extent, not to the same extent as like when I'm doing something like sort of semi or fully professionally and like some part of my livelihood depends on it, right? But like,
gotcha.
I yes do want to know the at least the rough mechanism for how a toaster works or how the microwave works, or you know, how an LCD screen works. But it's not to it's not to quite that exact level. But it certainly anytime that I was working on, like, even when I was like, you know, a kid growing up on the farm, I wanted to like mess around with all of the farm equipment to see like, okay, the PTO shaft turns and that's what turns this particular set of gears, and that makes, you know, that makes like the teeth on the haybine move back and forth, which cuts the hay, but it also turns this other set of gears that like makes the, I don't even remember the word for it, but that like makes essentially the part of the haybine that like compacts, like that crushes the hay also go. And like, you can see, and like seeing like how that whole chain worked was like, I don't know, I really, I like absolutely wanted to do that all the time as a kid.
Yeah.
I mean, my parents still, well, I mean, still tell the story of me like taking apart their friend's telephone. He had like an antique rotary phone, and I like was, I don't know, four or so, and they like just put me down in the living room next to it, and then they came back in, I had completely disassembled it.
Because you were like, how does this work?
Right, and I was, I'm still pretty sure I could have put it back together if they had let me.
I mean, you figured out how it worked, so I wouldn't put it past you. That's funny, yeah. I think that makes, that's a good skill set for a PhD, though.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, I don't want to claim that I was like particularly special, at least in terms of like, in general, in terms of that, maybe only slightly in terms of like wanting to go into the depths of it. But, you know, like I said, I think everybody in my lab had, you know, more or less the same skill set coming out as I did. Yeah.
Yeah. Let me check my questions.
True. What about you? How was your PhD like? You were in,
it was,
you were in like a complete, you were in an experimental field, right?
Yeah. So I like to say that mostly everyone I know from Haverford who went beyond physics into a PhD either went to study things bigger than us or smaller than us. And I went smaller than us. So I was studying nanomaterials.
Oh, cool.
Sort of from a physical chemistry side. But my my program was material science and for energy storage. So
very cool.
Yeah, like battery materials. So, so
you did not have the dilemma that I had coming out of grad school being like, oh, I need to do something that's going to actually contribute to the world.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, no, you make a good point. It was right. It was kind of right around when Tesla was becoming a thing. Mm-hmm. And so people were like really into batteries, and also like didn't understand them, so I feel like it was but I was also sick of them, you know, like I had been building little coin cell batteries for 5 years and I was like, I never want to see a battery ever again.
Did you go straight after undergrad?
I did. Okay, yeah,
so we were getting our PhDs at about the same time then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. And then I actually did a postdoc for a year and a half where, similar to I guess what you were saying about like switching gears, but like applying your skills. I forget what you said, but I found myself like managing this industry collaboration that was focused on like drones. Okay. And so nothing to do with my PhD, but because that's where the funding was, I was working with an industry partner on testing their drone setups in like the city of Philadelphia. And okay. It was just like very cool to kind of see a whole nother field of science, you know?
Yeah.
But, yeah. Well, I want to wrap up, but first, what else goes on in your life? What do you, used to fence? Is that correct?
Yeah. Until COVID.
So you stuck with it post Haverford?
Yeah, so when I was in grad school, I was coaching, UC Irvine had a fencing club, and I was helping to coach their saber team for at least a little bit while I was there. And I also went to a club in the area. Just not nearly as intensely, not nearly as focused on it as I was when I was in undergrad. Sure. But, you know, still doing it a bit, having fun with it. And then when I came back to the East Coast, actually, a friend of mine from high school was assistant coach at a club. And so I was like going there once a week, once or twice a week, until COVID shut everything down. Yeah. And then coming out of COVID, my wife and I had a kid.
So that's a different hobby.
Yeah. So that's been a lot of my time, since then. So I have not been able to get back to fencing since, but someday I will be able to. But yeah, I think also one thing that was really helpful for me when I was in grad school was I picked up the guitar. So I had something to do, to keep myself from going absolutely insane.
Yeah.
UCI is a really good school, but the location in Orange County leaves a bit to be desired, I would say. Especially like during my first year, I didn't have a car and it was impossible for me to get almost anywhere unless I could like, you know, bum a ride off of a friend. Yeah. So like having the guitar to just like have something to do other than just
work.
Well, first year especially, just like study for quals and fixate on them.
Or even think about studying, you know, just like to get your mind on something else.
Oh,
right?
God, if I never have to do anything like our qualifying exams ever again, I won't even be happy. That's like the default, is not having to do that.
Were they orals or were they written?
Written exam, 3 days of written exam. The way that it worked was, at least when I was going through it, was 3 days of exam on sort of the core courses in physics. It's the same as actually Haverford's upper division courses. So StatMech, E&M, Quantum, and Classical Physics. You have 3 chances to pass, and if you don't, then goodbye. The thing is, the first chance you get, which it's a use it or lose it like chance to take the test, right? So you can't just like not take it and then still have your 3 chances. And the first one of these is in between the second and third quarters. The UCI is a quarter system, not a semester system.
Okay.
All of the UC schools are like that, except for Berkeley, for whatever reason. But so this is before you've taken the second quarter of Jackson E&M. You also haven't taken. Quantum 3 is not on it. So that might keep taking it. Yeah, so it's like, so you haven't taken half of the E&M you're being tested on, and you have
pretty much just no stat back at that point.
So we had classical and first semester quantum, among like other courses during our first quarter, and then second quarter was stat mech, quantum 2, first semester or first half of Jackson E&M, and then third quarter was like second half of Jackson's E&M. But we hadn't gotten to that by the time we had to take the qualifying exam. So it's like especially stressful for that reason. And then also like the way that, I don't know, this may be apocryphal, but certainly this is kind of how it worked out my year, was that they aim for like roughly a 60% passage rate.
Oh, damn.
Yeah.
Every time or in full for the whole cohort?
Each test. So like over the course of 3 exams, like you're probably fine if you take it, as long as you like take it seriously and like do study. But I mean, also for me, it wasn't as big of a, there wasn't as much pressure, but if for the people who wanted to do like particle experiment, for example, right, that means going to CERN. And so if you want to start doing that, your research during the summer after your first year of courses, right, which everybody does, you need to have passed your quals, because the second opportunity to take the qualifying exams over the summer, right? So if you haven't passed, then you need to be spending your time studying for that and then taking that, which means you can't go to CERN to do your research, which means everybody who wanted to do high energy experiment, for the most part, like was under a lot of pressure to pass that first time. And there are other, you know, there are some professors who like won't take you into their lab if you don't pass the first time around, and like, you know, all of that kind of stuff. Yeah, I I'm not sure how much like the 60% passage rate is like apocryphal or not. Maybe like my year was just particularly bad. we only had like 60% during that first run at it. But yeah, that was fairly stressful.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah, I always used to say that. So we didn't have quals. We had like a candidacy presentation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Literature review. But I always say that that was the most stressful of all of my presentations, including the defense, because that's like, it's the first one you're doing that's like means something. And also it's like a goodbye afterwards if you don't, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I
that was good.
Yeah. I think for us, our like advancement to candidacy presentations were a little bit lower stress, just in terms of like, it was extremely rare for anyone to ever fail it, but like it definitely felt stressful because you're like, oh God, I don't want to be the first one to fail. And like, yeah. And also like, yeah, this is one of the first times that you're getting up and giving a presentation on like your work and what you want to do. And you like have a lot of like real ownership of it. And like, you know, it's stressful to give a conference talk about that, but like to some degree, if you bomb it, whatever, you can kind of put it out of your mind. But like, this is your advisor and your like committee that you really want to make a good impression on. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. High stress. Yeah,
for sure. High stress.
Grad school is fun.
All right. Grad school is fun. I know. I mean, it's kind of fun to talk to people about it when it's been such a long time, because it's usually some of the negative feelings have passed.
It diffuses a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. It diffuses, but there's still, you know, remembering some of those stressful times is, just reminds us how strong we are for getting through it. Right.
It's a good way to look at it.
There you go. Okay. So I have three kind of wrap up questions for you. Are you ready?
Let's go.
Okay. So what is something challenging that you faced, along the way of getting your PhD?
I think for me, one of the really big challenges that I was not actually expecting at all was just sort of living life like during my PhD. I guess I had never, you know, I grew up in New Jersey. I went to college at Haverford, right? It's very near. It was fairly near to my family. And then all of a sudden I was on the other side of the country from all of my high school friends, all of my college friends, all of my, like my entire social support system and network. And
at 22, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yep. And I like, that was extremely rough, and I kind of like disappeared a bit, certainly from like life during that time, where like most of the people that I was talking to were people in my cohort, you know, my then girlfriend, now wife, and like I talked to my family some, talked to some of my high school and college friends some, but like not a ton. And yeah, just I especially that first year, I mean, especially with like the qualifying exam sort of looming over two-thirds of it like that, that was a just generally like a rough time for me.
Yeah.
And sort of figuring out how to reestablish or how to like rebuild sort of a community and like the social, you know, network and you know, friendships and everything out there was, I think, more than I had bargained for.
I mean, they certainly don't put that in the welcome manual to grad school, but yeah, I mean, you're in a new place, you have new people around you. I can see that would be hard. Plus you're in a high stress environment, which I think makes any of that feel worse.
Yeah. And I mean, I think even if you're in a program where that's not, you know, you don't have like a super intense like qualifying exam happening at the end of your first year, or you're not like, you know, you don't have all of these like particular pressures that I was facing, right? Like, you know, every time you move up in academia, like you're passing through a bottleneck and the other people around you are just like generally like intimidating because you know what they've gone through and like what they've done to get there. And yeah. Like, it's not that I don't want to say that like everybody who didn't move through that, you know, bottleneck was less intelligent or less driven or whatever than you were, but anybody who was not as driven or not as focused or, you know, whatever, certainly didn't make it through that for the most part. And so yeah. just by virtue of that, right, like the people that you're comparing yourself to, you know, are stronger, and it can be tough for sure.
Yeah, good answer. So this could be related to that or not, but what advice would you give yourself in year one of your program?
I think sort of kind of a dual thing where, like, I think if I were to go back, you know, and give myself advice, one thing I would say is certainly like try to reach out to more people and more of, you know, the community around, then maybe feels even like natural or comfortable at first, because it really makes a huge difference when you do, just to have that, you know, support system and to have those friendships and those relationships and to be developing them. And then also, you know, probably call home a little bit more often than I did, because I was in kind of like a, especially during my first year, I was in a pretty bad funk. And I think having those, like, you know, talking to my parents, talking to my friends, you know, from back home more often would have been a good way to at least help with that. And then sort of this goes back to something we were talking about a lot earlier, but I think even though I wasn't planning on leaving academia at that point, just taking more advantage and like being more intentional about going to, you know, like the career center and trying to at least like check out that a bit more, so that, you know, I had more options open to me and I was more, you know, more prepared when I did decide, like, actually, no, I do want to leave academia. I mean, you know,
like keep an open mind, right? And like not necessarily close any doors before you.
Precisely. Yeah. And I mean, like, that's not something that I had any time to be actually doing as a first year grad student, but like certainly during my second and third years and after that, I think that would have been really, you know, I would have benefited a lot from that, at least.
I think back, I kind of wish sometimes that I didn't come into Haverford with such a plan to major in physics, because I feel like I took other classes but didn't really consider them. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I think a lot of people maybe look back and say they wish they had kept a more open mind earlier, because like you said, your perspective changed at the end, and
yeah,
it could change at any point.
Yeah, suddenly you're like face to face with like the, you know, you're in a situation and you realize, oh, actually I feel differently than I thought I would, or something happens and you have to make a different decision, right? And having that flexibility, like, it's hard. Especially in grad school, it's very easy to just sort of go along with the flow into, yes, like, you know, and I, like, this almost feels cliche to say, but it's true. It is very easy to just sort of go along with what, you know, sort of your professors expect, because it's what they did, and not really think
too
much.
The story is written for you. It's like the path is written for you at that point.
Yeah. And it turns out that's actually not the case. You can write whatever story you feel, you know, you want.
Oh, there you go. That'll be the quote that I use for this podcast. Okay, last question. So looking back, do you have a good memory or story from your time in grad school?
I have a lot.
That's great. I love that.
Actually, I have a hard time.
You don't have to tell them all, but.
Are you sure? We could be here for a while still. yeah, I guess. I think because it sort of has come back around to where I am now, and it's sort of kind of the thing that I'm trying to recapture in my current job and in my current newly re-academicized life. Mm-hmm. I think one thing that I do look back on really fondly is the first time that I went to a conference, and not only, you know, presented research that I had done that I felt like ownership of, but that I also, where I felt like I really had like a total handle on like the background and all of the underlying issues and all of sort of the subsequent implications of what I was talking about. And then after my talk, you know, discussing with just other people at the conference and having just having a fruitful scientific conversation and coming out of that feeling, you know, enervated to go back and do more research, and then also feeling like this is a potentially like really interesting and fruitful collaboration that I want to, you know, develop and, you know, be a part of. And I think it was Nicolas Martin at Strasbourg who I was having that conversation with, and like we've like came out of that and we were like, yeah, this is a really cool thing that we should work on together. And we didn't. I left the field. But like and like even I mean this was a few years before that, like before I had defended my PhD, and I had ended up getting pulled into other directions, and by the time I was like coming back to it, I had then decided, actually, no, I'm gonna leave astronomy. But like that feeling, the first time that I like really had that feeling of like true like mastery, and that like this is something that I can do and could do and like could continue to do, was really cool. And yeah, it's something that, you know, now that I'm working in atmospheric physics and like climate modeling, is it's, I guess, yeah, it's the dragon I'm still chasing. yeah,
I know exactly what you mean. I think it's almost like you realize at some point that A, you're the expert in the room, yeah, right? Nobody else knows what you're talking about as much as you do. Mm-hmm. And because of that, people are coming up to you with their ideas and want to talk to you and collaborate with you. And that's such a cool feeling.
Yeah, it really is. It's really, really cool. And it like it just like reinvigorates you to keep doing science too.
Yeah,
for me it does, at least. I don't know, but like it absolutely was.
I mean, I went to a ton of conferences, and I think that that's why, because every time I came back from a conference, I was like, that was sick.
Yeah,
let's do it again.
Absolutely. For sure. Yeah, completely.
Yeah, well, Oliver, it's really been a pleasure catching up after all these years.
Yeah, it has been. We should not wait another decade plus before we chat again.
Thanks to Oliver for coming on the show. If you or someone you know wants to be in your Beyond Impact Factor, feel free to reach out via Instagram and follow us for updates at Impact Factor Pod. Thank you all for listening, and have a great week.